Hey guys, it's Chase Will, host of the Family Fright Night Horror Podcast. Here to quickly let you know, I'm going to be at the Scares That Care 8, July 29th through 31st in Williamsburg, Virginia, where I'll have my coming-of-age novel Moving Through for sale, along with a special bonus book that will only be available at the convention. Be sure to hit the subscribe button for new episodes of the show every Tuesday and Thursday at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and follow me at chasewill.com. Enjoy the show!
Welcome to the Family Fright Night Horror Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Family Fright Night Horror Podcast. Today I'm joined by Paul Tremblay, author of Head Full of Ghosts, Cabin at the End of the World, and the upcoming The Pallbearers Club, coming July 5th. Paul, how are you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me here, Chase.
Thank you for coming, man.
My family's all asleep.
Where are you at? Are you on the East Coast or West Coast?
I'm on the East Coast, yeah. In a town just, about 20 minutes south of Boston.
Nice. So today we're talking about 2008's Lake Mungo by Joel Anderson. This is one of your favorites, right?
One of my favorites, absolutely.
What is it you love about this movie?
Oh, I don't know. It was just how it made me feel the first time I saw it. I first heard of the movie, my social media consumption at that point was mainly LiveJournal. Does anyone out there remember LiveJournal? the old blogging, blogosphere site? I don't think I saw it in 2008. I probably saw it in like 2009, 2010 or something like that. But some writer friends that I respect were talking about the movie and how much they really liked it. And I think the first person to talk about it, why am I forgetting her name? It's because it's 11 o'clock at night where I am. oh my gosh, this is terrible. Gemma Files. Sorry, Gemma.
To Gemma.
Yeah. I think of the people I knew, she was the first person to see it. So for me then, let's say it was 2009, there wasn't really streaming or anything. So my only way really to get my hands on it was I found a used DVD. And at that point it was packaged with 8 films to die for. I don't know if you've seen any of those. Mm-hmm.
Those are all pretty DVDs good too.
Yeah. So like the cover of that DVD has nothing to do with the movie. There's like a long haired woman. Looks like she's sort of breaking out of water and her head's back into screaming. And like an image that's not in the movie has nothing to do with the movie. It's just
the poster cell.
Yeah. The poster cell for the After Dark Horror Fest 4, 8 films to die for, and it's such a quiet and restrained, but dread inducing movie. I guess we'll get into spoilers at some point, but there was the scene, sure. The scene of, when Alice sees her doppelganger, right? Sees her mm-hmm. future. That broke me. I watching it home, everyone was asleep, sort of like now. watching it like in a dark room. And I had to, I had to grab my phone because I could see the image coming. I was like, I can't deal. I have to have like a little piece of light. It was just so like the lead up to that revealed to me is one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen on film. And whereas the rest of the movie is just, like I said, so mannered, so quaint, so restrained, but it was just that perfect build up to that moment. It just left me sort of semi obsessed with the movie.
It's hard to find those kinds of movies now too. Movies that can genuinely give you dread and not just disgust.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I'm trying to think of some recent ones that.
Do you ever see the movie Shudder, the original?
No.
Oh, there's a scene where the guy goes down in this basement, this like abandoned building, and this ghost is coming at him and it's like trying to move like a human, but it's like shambling. It's like, it's very clearly something trying to mimic a human. And that reminded me of that feeling of dread going on.
All right, I'm going to write that down. It's me clicking my pen.
Yeah, I give Paul Tremblay a recommendation.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm like a card carrying scaredy cat. So, I mean, I love obviously horror movies, but they also still give me nightmares and make me freaked out if I'm home alone at night in the dark.
I think that works well for your writing too.
Yeah, I guess so. I hope so.
Well, because when I was reading Head Full of Ghosts, there's a scene early on where they're just talking about the story that the older sister's telling her because they're like trading stories.
Right.
And the way she's just, going on with the details and kind of telling her there's nothing wrong here. This is what happened. It's like that started the dread right there. And then it got worse and worse.
And I was like, oh shit. So I was out walking at like 3 a.m. listening to it.
Oh, nice.
Which is always a mistake for scary books is, you know, walking in the middle of nowhere at 3 a.m.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And Joy Osmansky does such an amazing job narrating or performing that book.
Yeah,
I don't listen to a lot of the audiobooks that I've had done. I don't know, because it's kind of weird, but I, you know, this was my first big book in a while. And so I had a long drive to Pennsylvania. I listened to it. And like when I heard her Voice of Mary, it gave me shivers.
Oh, it was so good.
Anyway, yeah.
I think there's a lot of a crossover too between Lake Mungo and Head Full of Ghosts. Was that on purpose? Did one kind of inform the other?
I'm sure. I mean, I'd say it's definitely way more overt in the fall, in the book after Head Full of Ghosts. It's called Disappearance of Devil's Rock, which, you know, probably of this run of horror novels is probably sold the least, you know, which is fine. Not everything is going to sell. But like the people who like that book really like it. But anyway, no, Disappearance of Devil's Rock is definitely my British publicist and friend Lydia gets mad at me if I describe that book as Lake Mungo fan fiction. So I won't go that far. But, you know, so if A Head Full of Ghosts was me sort of definitely taking all the different exorcist kind of stuff or possession kind of things and mashing it all in. With Disappearance of Devil's Rock, I took the disappearance of a teenager, and I really tried to mash together. Actually, my three main sources of things that I was inspired by were three Australian films, like Mungo, I think is probably the most obvious. Also, Picnic at Hanging Rock, you know, obviously with the title.
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Picnic at Hanging Rock, the Peter Weir movie in the 70s, I believe. Very strange movie, very haunting.
I'll check that out.
Yeah, it's about, it takes place in like the early 1900s and was based on an art and adaptation of a novel, all girls school in Australia. And there's a school trip to Hanging Rock, Picnic at Hanging Rock. Yeah. At the rock. And then some of the girls don't come back and you don't never really get an answer as to why. And it's very bizarre film, very, very trippy. So there's, you know, like Mungo and Picnic at Hanging Rock, which are sort of, you know, very sort of ambiguous. You're not quite sure what's going on kind of films. And then there's this other Australian movie called Snowtown Murders, which is just brutal reality. One of those kind of movies that you only watch once. I mean, it's an amazing film, but
I'll be checking them both.
You're not going to sit through it a second time.
Oh, it's one of those movies where you kind of only enjoy it the first time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see. I like those kinds of movies because, you know, with horror, people complain that, well, it's no rewatch value. I'm like, that's because it scares you the first time. You're not going to get that same scare the second time, except for The Exorcist. That always kind of scares me.
Yeah. It's funny. Like, so when I watched Lake Mungo, or rewatch it, I should say, I think the value for me comes for, you know, sometimes I'll watch it to see like, how did they do this? how did Anderson, the director, do this? There was a new Blu-ray that was put out within the last couple of years by some British Blu-ray. I'm forgetting. And I couldn't find it in my house before this podcast, or I might've lent it to my brother or something. But that new release, you know, has a little booklet with it and like in a making of it. And it's really fascinating how they almost went into it without a script pretty much and just like a plan and really had the actors ad lib a lot of, you know, they would give them some direction, like, but really had them try to come up with what their lines would be almost off the cuff. So it would feel like natural, feel like you were actually a part of like a documentary kind of thing. So I found that fascinating that they were able to build the dread intention as they were able to without really that like scripted roadmap to it. A lot by feel and also shooting everything on the age of the camera that would have been like, so they had to find like a Nokia first or third generation cell phone that had the video, and it was terrible grainy video. And they talked about how, you know, they tried just shooting the video and then try to muck it up afterwards. And it, you know, it looked like, oh, someone took real video and mucked it up, as opposed to an actual pixelated, night shot from a crappy cell phone that you can see. So, you know, a lot of ways I'm really drawn to how the realism in Lake Mungo, like that real detailed realism, makes it this weird thing that lives in like this liminal space. And that's such, I don't know, to me, it's such a magic trick and something I often try to do in my own fiction.
I feel like if somebody had showed me Lake Mungo, not telling me it was a fictional movie, I would have bought that this was a real documentary because everything is right. So perfect.
For sure.
I think it's part of the scary thing. It's part of what's scary about it too, is not just the movie itself, but the fact that they were able to pull it off. Like they were able to fool me that well. It's like, it's one of those movies you don't know what's real and what's not until right. like it's pointed out to you of here's how they did it.
Yeah. And it definitely takes the story itself definitely takes a few turns. Like when you're first starting it, like, oh, this is definitely something supernatural, ghost story. And then it takes this unexpected 180 degree turn into what was happening with Alice when she was babysitting for the neighbors. And it's mm-hmm. Really creepy and icky. Like, oh, the, you know, then you're finding out obviously, before that, like her brother is setting up some of the ghostly images that, they end up finding. But then obviously when they actually visit Lake Mungo, which, as an American, not knowing much about the geography of Australia, and this actually I didn't know until I watched the most recent Blu-ray, which I thought, again, was really interesting to have the background of Lake Mungo, this area that, obviously, the colonialists stole from the Aboriginals, and the lake itself is this dried lake that it has actually quite a bit of meaning to the Aboriginal population of Australia too. So there was like still all these layers that, we get to sort of peel back and investigate, the more we watch the movie.
Yeah. One thing I appreciate about it, sorry, listeners, is that it involves like viewer interaction. Like you're putting stuff together. It's not just being fed to you, you're getting context clues from the way things are said.
Right.
It's almost like reading a book where you have to really pay attention to stuff. You have to really see things and absorb them and, think about them critically. I mean, even before the ending is given away, even before the icky parts,
yeah,
like you can kind of find it on your own. If you rewatch it, it's like the clues are there.
Yeah, no. And then, so there's all this realism, but also it still finds a way to be cinematic in many ways too, where, those are the more of the documentary style shots where you see just sort of the vast vistas of, the open plains of Australia. And, to me, like, visually, it's like it just gives you this real sense of grief that hovers over the movie that, just feels so authentic and raw.
Mm-hmm. Taking a left turn here, going back to books, you are a fan of House of Leaves, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. It's one of my favorites. I've managed to read it twice.
How did you do that?
Yeah, it's
that book and Infinite Jest, two books I respect anyone who's read more than once.
Yeah, I couldn't make my way through Infinite Jest. I tried, but no, House of Leaves. Yeah, I guess in some way a formative read for me. And I've always been, well, I think especially because of that book, but like ever since, I've always been a sucker for interesting ways to tell stories or different types of narratives. And hopefully not as a gimmick, I think there are, I won't say any books. I mean, there are some books out there that use sort of those postmodern techniques of, employing letters or employing footnotes or employing something, and it can feel gimmicky. But so that's the trick as sort of the writer. If I'm going to do stuff like that, like I want it to feel like it has to be there for the story. There's no other way to tell that story. And I don't know. I think for House of Leaves, I think there's no other way to tell that story.
Yeah.
The four different stories within stories and the main story of this house that's bigger and bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
And there's like there's the quote at the beginning. I think it says something like, you are not who you think you are, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And I was reading about that because it was being like dissected online. It was saying, well, look at yourself as you're reading the book. Did you ever think you'd be the kind of person like turning a book in your hand, holding up to a mirror,
right?
Flipping back and forth. It's like the book does change you. It's like you become different reading the book.
I spent so much time decoding the letter from his mom and the
dude. I was so excited.
Right? Yeah.
Going through that part, I was in a coffee shop, like a detective in a movie, like taking notes, smoking furiously, like what's going on?
I know. And I hate like puzzles like that. Normally I'm usually terrible at them, but no, I was all in. When I read it the second time, I didn't go through and resolve the puzzle. I had it marked up in my book. So,
movie wise now, today's movies, what is something you're looking forward to? Or what's missing from cinema today, in your opinion? Because I know you've done like a lot of research on movies and you're pretty well spoken.
Oh, thanks. I don't know what's missing. I mean, don't know, probably for many horror fans, a typical complaint is most Hollywood sort of studio horror productions I find lacking. Yeah, there are exceptions. Obviously, you know, Jordan Peele's movie, so I'm super looking forward to Nope this summer.
I like how they don't give anything away in the trailer. I still have no idea what the movie is.
Yeah, and I've heard like a rumor that they might be just fucking with people with some of the trailers too and showing stuff that might not actually be in there. So I don't know. I'm just really excited.
Me too.
Obviously, Get Out is, you know, a groundbreaking movie, and I really loved Us. I think I, you know, in some ways, I might have enjoyed Us just because of its weirdness that sort of appeals to me, where like he doesn't fully answer or tell you like it you know, the answers aren't easy as to why what's happening on the screen or what they represent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so certainly looking forward to that movie. Man, I'm trying to think what else is coming. I'm totally spacing. I'm actually, I mean, this isn't a new movie, but I'm just really excited that they're showing The Thing, Carpenter's The Thing, on big screens for the 40th anniversary, the Sunday, the 19th and the 21st. Ooh. So like check your local theaters. I know there's one. I'll probably try to sneak out on Sunday night, because I've never seen The Thing on the big screen. I mean,
you just made my Sunday plans.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. And actually I'm going to see The Black Phone, and actually I'm going to be at a screening and interviewing Joe Hill after the showing of The Black Phone. So that'll be a lot of fun.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So that'll be in Dedham, Massachusetts. I'm not sure when this podcast is running, but the 24th, 7 PM. Yeah. So if any Massachusetts people are listening, that should be a fun time.
I'm looking forward to that movie a lot, because the trailer makes it look so damn creepy. And Ethan Hawke is one of those actors where I can watch almost anything he does.
Even Daybreakers. Like, for sure. Yeah. I'm trying to think of, I don't know of other, I haven't really scoped out other movies that are coming out. But movies recently that I've really enjoyed tend to be more of the smaller independent movies. Saint Maud is one of my favorites of recent years.
Oh God.
Loved that movie. I thought it was amazing.
That final scene.
The perfect, like the last image is just so horrifying, but perfect. It's so horrible. It's kind of weird calling it perfect, but I guess that's what we do.
That poor girl.
Horror fans. Yeah.
Like I was watching that and I was like, is there really something going on here? Or is she crazy? You know, is it a little bit of both? Is she seeing some things, but there really is something else going on?
Right. Yeah.
Like that ending scene. Oh my God. If you guys haven't seen it, check it out. I'm not going to spoil what
sure,
it is.
Sure. Like, and it's not a huge spoiler, but I thought it was like, just a brilliant. I mean, it's I'm going to say it's simple because it's not a simple movie, but like, a simple twist on what could be like just a run of the mill possession story. It's like, oh, what if this person was possessed by God, right? That idea, as opposed to being possessed by, you know, we've seen that movie and I've written that book. Mm-hmm. We've all seen that 100 times by some sort of demon. I thought a fantastic movie. And I added that soundtrack to my rotation of, if I need to block out noise, I'll write to movie soundtrack. So Saint Maud is in the rotation.
What do you think of the A24 movies?
Oh, big fan. You know, Robert Eggers' movies. Obviously, I love The Witch, The Lighthouse. I think Saint Maud is an A24 movie, right? So
I think it is.
Yeah, it is. For sure. Definitely a fan.
Those are all really good. I was talking to somebody last week about The Lighthouse. We were discussing how that's a movie that demands a rewatch, where the first time you're not going to catch everything,
right?
Which I think is probably the perfect thing for a box office success is, you know, it's you're going to get rewatches. People will have to come back to see this.
Yeah. It's although like I don't know if that movie was built for box office success.
it's an art house film, of course not.
But certainly, you know, DVD, Blu-ray rewatches.
Oh, yeah. And what are you reading nowadays?
So like I'm sort of in a very lucky situation where I'm asked frequently to read like early copies of books to maybe give a blurb. So
nice.
I just finished a book by Mariana Enriquez, Argentinian writer who has fast become like my favorite working horror writer now. But she had two short story collections come out in recent years, one called Things We Lost in the Fire, which is one of my favorite collections of recent years. But she has a big, fat 700-page novel coming out in the U.S. in February called Our Share of Night. And, you know, the editor sort of described it to me as Roberto Bolaño meets Stephen King. And it's fairly accurate. You know, it takes place over a few decades, but mainly I would say the 80s and 90s in Argentina. Sort of, so you get the story of this sort of rich family that's a part of a cult. I don't want to give too much away. But there are these people sort of in the family, not in the family, but at the same time, you know, Argentina is dealing with, you know, fascism and the deaths and disappearances of all these dissidents. And it's just this really incredible story. And, you know, it goes for a long, it'll go for a long time just dealing with the characters, you know, again, rooted in realism. And then it'll have these like starbursts of just batshit disturbing imagery and stuff that happens. And it just takes your breath away.
I like when books can do that.
Yeah. So definitely keep an eye out. Well, it'll be out in February, but I'm sure I'll be talking quite a bit about that book. It's amazing.
And blurbs help too, because there was a book earlier today I was looking at actually, and I saw you blurbed it, and I was like, now I must buy it. This is a sign. It was Things Have Gotten Worse Since We Last Spoke.
I think it's called. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, it's a crazy book.
Yeah, I've heard some people talk about it. I was kind of on the fence, but I was reading like reviews, and everyone was saying, dude, give it a chance. You're going to love it.
Yeah, Eric LaRocca. He's a super talented, young, like he's only in his 20s, a bastard writer. Definitely someone to watch. No, he's a really, very talented. Very like sort of had already sort of has his own voice and has his own sort of slant on horror fiction. I'm hoping to get a chance to read it. You asked me what I've been reading. I'm looking around, but Werner Herzog has his first novel out.
What?
Yeah.
Way.
I don't have it in front of me. It's called, what is it called? It's a very, it's probably more like a novella. See, my brain doesn't work. I left it on a different table. Oh yeah. But no, it just came out this week. So I bought that. So I'm definitely going to read Werner Herzog's novel, in which he's a character. So it starts off where like he's the documentarian, but it goes off into fiction where I think the basis of it is that he's talking to or interviewing a Japanese soldier who, you know, who spent decades, you know, living with the idea that the war was still going kind of thing. But
I will be really interesting. For this one. Yeah. You know what the title is?
The Shadow something. I'm forgetting. But I mean, I'm sure if you Google Werner Herzog novel, that'll be the first thing that comes up.
I will be finding it.
You know, my defense for not knowing the titles, I haven't read it yet. So it's not that bad. I just happened to buy it and look at it and take a picture and post it. But I haven't read it yet.
Now, we have writers on the show. I like to ask because everyone's kind of different. Do you have a particular process you use when you're writing? Does it vary from project to project? And like, how many drafts do you go through?
You know, I'd say my general process is kind of the same most of the time. You know, I may try to like tweak things here and there, but I would say in general, for a novel, most of them have started with, I'll take a few weeks to maybe even a month or more to write like a 10-page plot summary. And usually that process is me jotting down notes in a notebook and just trying to come up with what I think the story, the very bare bones of what the story is going to be. You know, for some novels, my summary might only end up being like 2 or 3 pages. A Headful of Ghosts, I actually didn't write a summary for. I felt, you know, I was lucky with that story, just sort of fell in my lap. But then when I actually get to actual writing, everything's on the laptop. I wish I could write longhand, but I can't. But I do a ton of, I edit as I go. So by the time I have like a full draft, it's fairly clean or clean-ish. It's not like something I'm going to like rip up and start over from scratch. It's, you know, I aim for like 500 words a day. And typically I don't start the day until I go over what I wrote the day before. And usually I'll go back to the beginning of that chapter. So by the time I finish a chapter, I've done quite a bit of editing on it. So I go really slowly forward, but you know, it adds up. Like that's sort of the game of a novel. You know, it usually takes me a year. You know, it never feels like I'm going to be finished, but then magically
it's the curse, right? Yeah. I like that process. I've never actually tried that before, like going back each day and rereading what you wrote the night before. Like for some reason that just always felt weird to me. Like I always like start off, put it away, and then come back over and over again. So it's like it's kind of a shitty cycle, if we're being honest, because it's never done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like whatever works for you, though. That's like the thing. Like, I know I envy writers who can just like spill it all out and then revise. Because to me, like well, editing isn't fun, but I definitely, like, when I'm at the revision process, I kind of feel like I'm almost done. And that's sort of the part I'm addicted to, like, to have a finished thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the rest of the time, I'm sort of a miserable bastard.
Well, if you're not miserable, you're not a writer, right?
Yeah, true, right.
I got to bring it to you, like, the other day, I was reading this book I got a long time ago, and I was reading your biography in the back. It just says,
oh, wow.
It just says, Paul Tremblay is tall. I thought that was
it's
funny.
True. Yeah.
Best biography ever.
Yeah. Geez, what year was that published? Probably.
Oh, like, shit. That's got to be like early 2000s.
So I didn't have very many writing credits to my name at that point. It's like, why the hell am I even in an on writing book at that point? But
yeah, on writing horror. This is by the.
Yeah, it was from the Horror Writers Association, right? Yeah.
2006.
Okay. Yeah. So I'd sold some short stories, but that was about it. I was tall. And I had opinions on writing, apparently. Why the hell do I have opinions on writing then? But whatever.
Well, they went somewhere.
Yeah, I guess maybe it worked out. Maybe my opinion was, no, just spill it all out. And don't edit as you go. Shows what I know.
So wrapping up, final thoughts on Lake Mungo. Should there be a sequel? Should there be any movies like
no,
it? Is it a once
funny,
in a lifetime?
No, it's, I don't know. Leave it alone. I mean, you know, have, you know, reissue it, have people see it. It's funny, like when I first, my first experience with, and I haven't had a lot of experience, but my first experience with Hollywood, with the idea of, oh, something might get optioned with A Head Full of Ghosts. I was on the phone with a producer and she happened to mention, and she worked for the production company that did actually, in fact, end up optioning A Head Full of Ghosts. So it's Allegiance Theater in conjunction with Team Downey are the producers who are still, they optioned it in 2015. And here we are 7 years later, sort of still working on it. But
Team Downey, yeah, granted, Jr., right?
What's that? Yeah, what's his production company.
Oh, nice.
Granted, they've had some hurdles, like, you know, the movie Head Full of Ghosts would have filmed the summer of 2020 if, you know, the world hadn't stopped. Obviously, there are much bigger problems than the movie not being made. But, you know, they're sort of redoing it. Anyway, this one of these first producers that I talked to just happened to mention, it's like, oh, yeah, I'm a project I'm working on is to remake Lake Mungo, like, you know, for American audiences. I was like, what?
Don't do that. No. Leave it alone. No,
so obviously, that never happened. So.
Why do they have to Americanize every good foreign film? Like the movie Inside, the French one, they remade it and it was awful. Just like the remake of, and Martyrs too. They remade Martyrs for American cinema. Bad.
Yeah, I tend to be a wimp with the extreme stuff. So I haven't seen a lot of the French extreme movies.
They go there.
Does Raw count? Is that considered?
What is it?
Raw, the movie Raw that came out a few years ago. Same director as Titane.
I think they built it as extreme, but if I remember it correctly, it didn't have a whole lot of gore. Yeah. It was more of a buildup.
Yeah. No, I really, that's a recent movie that I really enjoyed. It was Raw. What was the point of any of that? Oh yeah. No, don't remake Lake Mungo. Just see it again.
Leave it alone. Yeah. Hollywood, if you're listening, I don't know why you would be. Leave it alone.
Right.
Paul, man, thank you so much for joining. This has been fun. Sure. I love talking to you, man. Otherwise, have a great night.
All right. Thank you.